Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, congressional debate over the Libya war shows an apparently bipartisan sense of frustration and outrage over the NATO mission. This has triggered a serious debate over the legality of the war, among other things. But there's almost no discussion of whether the pretext for the war has actually held up. Patrick Coburn of The Independent has been investigating the stories of mass rapes and mercenary fighters that paved the way to war. He'll talk to us about what he's found. Also on the show, the story of Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath continues to unfold with the trial of five police officers charged with killing and wounding unarmed civilians escaping the floodwaters and then covering up the crime. Our guest says the story of Danziger Bridge rewrites the official narrative of what happened in the days after Katrina. Jordan Flaherty is a New Orleans-based journalist and an editor at Left Turn magazine. All of that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
Barack Obama's June 22nd announcement of a phased troop withdrawal from Afghanistan was, to many outlets, a bold move. The Los Angeles Times called it a rapid withdrawal. That seems hard to square with the facts. Assuming the plan is actually carried out on schedule, troop levels at the end of 2012 will be about double what they were when Obama took office. So how did war opponents react to the news? According to the June 23rd USA Today, the plan, quote, was deemed a step in the right direction Wednesday by a growing and bipartisan anti-war movement, close quote. That's not how the actual anti-war movement reacted, though, which the article seems to establish since it finds Democrats and a few activists expressing disappointment with Obama's blueprint. The paper seems to have a problem with its Afghan war discussions. The very next day, the paper boasted a headline, "Drawdown's Effects Debated." The piece quoted a variety of pro-war voices, including Senator Joe Lieberman and Bush UN Ambassador John Bolton. One expert quoted near the end points out, approvingly, that there will still be many thousands of U.S. troops in the country. That's not much of a debate. But given that the paper apparently thinks the anti-war movement supports Obama's plan, it's not a surprise.
Choosing to quote or not quote particular kinds of people is one way that media show which side they're on. But sometimes reporters just come out and say what they feel. That can get them in trouble unless their opinions don't push the wrong buttons. NBC correspondent Richard Engel, appearing on the network's Meet the Press show on June 19th, called for more bombing in Libya.
But I think this debate about Libya, for example, I just came from Libya before I came here, and the fact of the matter is the war in Libya right now is not very serious. The NATO is not doing a terribly good job. The rebels need a lot more help. The bombing campaign in Tripoli barely exists. Every once in a while, there's a few bombs on mostly empty compounds, and people go about their lives more or less unaffected. It's not the kind of thing that's going to drive Gaddafi from power. And a lot of European nations who are now trying to lead this fight, which and are struggling to do it, are looking at this debate within the United States to end the U.S. support for NATO. If the U.S. ended its support for NATO in Libya, NATO really is dead.
That was NBC's Richard Engel. There's something telling about a reporter warning about the dire consequences of too much debate over war.
In a rational media world, right-wing provocateur Andrew Breitbart would be shunned. His Acorn videos were deceptively edited hit jobs intended to destroy the community activist group. Media followed along, and the anti-Acorn agenda thrived. He smeared Agriculture Department worker Shirley Sherrod as a racist based on another deceptively edited video. But lo and behold, there is Breitbart profiled in the June 27th New York Times, which tells readers about the, quote, undercover video he released of Acorn workers offering advice on how to evade taxes and conceal child prostitution, close quote. The videos actually show no such thing, as critics like Fair have pointed out to the Times. But since the inaccuracies have been printed as fact in the so-called paper of record so many times, they're treated as if they are. And that's really the Breitbart lesson. Scream about liberal media bias, and at the same time, enjoy massive publicity for your mostly factually challenged exposés. How does he get away with it? Because sometimes news outlets decide they can't tell who's lying and who's not. Just look at how the Times explained it. telling readers that Breitbart's videos, quote, tend to act as political Rorschach tests. If you agree with them, you think what he does is citizen journalism. If you don't, his work is little more than crowdsourced political sabotage that freely distorts the facts, close quote. Now that is absurd. If you think that Breitbart distorts the facts, that's because he does. To suggest otherwise is to assert that there's no way to ever know the truth about anything, which is unfortunately too often the standard in so-called objective journalism.
Well, speaking of media figures who have a distant relationship with the truth, on his June 23rd program, Fox's Bill O'Reilly gave viewers a lesson in, well, something.
So why is this happening? Well, it all boils down to political philosophy. President Obama is a liberal guy who believes the Fed should run the economic show, and he hired advisors who believe that as well. The administration then set out to fight the recession by spending government money, the so-called stimulus. That ran up trillions of dollars of debt. Historically, the way out of recessions is to give the private sector lower tax rates and reward people, businesses, for hiring other people. But the Obama administration has resisted that.
Of course, this is the same Barack Obama who declared, quote, I am a pro-growth free market guy. I love the market, close quote. It's a pretty strange sentiment for a supposed economic nationalist. But seriously, who does O'Reilly think are Obama's left-wing economic advisors? Larry Summers? The stimulus package, a mix of spending and tax cuts, cost around $787 billion. The Congressional Budget Office estimates its 10-year cost will be slightly higher, around $820 billion, which is still miles away from trillions. And the deficit debt problems that O'Reilly is concerned with are due primarily to the George Bush tax cuts, the recession, and the Iraq-Afghan wars. Few would argue that the spending associated with economic recovery plays any major role. As for lower corporate tax rates, lots of business folks would love to pay less, sure. But if O'Reilly thinks history shows that lowering those tax rates is the way out of a recession, he must be getting his history from the same place he gets his economics.
And finally, when you're talking about media outlets' priorities, some facts speak for themselves. Newspaper giant Gannett will be laying off 700 employees, or about 2% of its workforce. In a memo published online by Jim Romanesco, U.S. Newspapers President Bob Dickey explained that, quote, the economic recovery is not happening as quickly or favorably as we had hoped, close quote. Oh, it's favorable for him. He took home $3.4 million last year, including a $600,000 bonus. That's compared to a mere $1.9 million in 2009. Romanesco also notes that Gannett paid CEO Craig Dubow $9.4 million in 2010. That's double his 2009 pay. So apparently firing people is not its own reward.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
The media coverage of the NATO war in Libya is not entirely uncritical. The fact that political elites in this country are divided on the war means that there is a little more space for dissenting views. But while views differ on the wisdom or even the legality of the Libya war, one thing appears beyond debate. Muammar Gaddafi's actions against his own people were uniquely vicious and deadly. But how well have the claims about Viagra and mass rapes or helicopter attacks on civilian protesters held up since the start of the war? Patrick Coburn is a correspondent for the London Independent who has been looking into these stories, and he joins us now. Patrick Coburn, welcome to Counterspin.
Hello, nice to be here.
It's a truism about wartime journalism that there's going to be propaganda from every side. We've seen a run of stories in the U.S. papers laughing off the Libyan government's attempts to show civilian casualties to the world. But there's been little, if any, attention paid to the other side. From the very start of the war, we heard about Gaddafi handing out Viagra to encourage rapes, hiring foreign mercenaries from Africa to fight on his behalf, using helicopters against protesters. Some of that sounded at least plausible, but how well has any of this been documented so far?
Well, it hasn't. That's the extraordinary thing. There's no evidence of mass rape. There's no evidence of helicopter attacks on demonstrators. There's no evidence of mercenaries. I mean, this isn't just what I'm saying, but Amnesty International a team of investigators in Libya, really from the time the first unrest started on the 15th of February. They were there shortly afterwards. And they found no evidence for this. The mass rape, which is the most melodramatic claim, the main evidence, a woman who said that she conducted a survey, that she's a Libyan doctor, that she conducted a survey, distributed 70,000 questionnaires, received 60,000 replies. And I think she said that 259 women had volunteered they'd been raped, and she'd interviewed 140 of them. But when Amnesty and Human Rights Watch went to see her and asked if they wouldn't be put in touch with any of these rape victims, she said she'd lost touch with them. So there really isn't any evidence. Amnesty also talked to doctors, to psychiatrists. Nobody was able to point to anybody who'd been raped. There was a couple of soldiers captured. Mm-hmm. Who are shown off by the rebel authorities, who said, yes, their officers had raped some women, they'd participated in this. But when they were interviewed separately by human rights organizations in Arabic, they denied most of what they'd said and gave very different stories.
Talk to us a little bit about the practice of foreign correspondents dropping into a story like this. You've written about this. You know, a journalist can go to rebel-held Benghazi or to Tripoli, and it does seem that the journalism coming out of Benghazi is very flattering to the rebel side. We have U.S. war correspondents on television saying, you know, all out calling for more bombing, that the rebels can take down the Libyan government if they're just given a little more assistance from NATO.
I find it quite extraordinary how partisan the reporting has been from Benghazi and Misrata. I mean, this started with Al Jazeera, but it sort of spread to all the other Western networks as well. I mean, some of the reporters are almost like people giving a stump speech in favor of the rebels. And great credulity about evidence of atrocity. When we spoke about mass rape, which there's no evidence, the Viagra story, where just local people claim they'd found Viagra in tanks there, sort of people dealing with the press in Benghazi, produced these sort of very clean white packets of Viagra claiming they'd come from destroyed tanks. But I've seen the tanks, you know, they're completely burnt out, they're completely mangled. It'd be pretty amazing if a sort of squeaky clean white packet could come out of this sort of burnt out metal. So, you know, mercenaries, yes, at the beginning, the rebels showed off some, I think they were Central Africans who they said were mercenaries. But actually, they were quietly released later because it turned out they were simply undocumented workers who had been caught up in the fighting. Nobody's actually produced any of these mercenaries yet. The unfortunate effect here is that sometimes sort of people, there's a good deal of racism in Libya, that somebody from Ghana, somebody from Chad is picked up on the front line and they think he's a mercenary and they put a bullet in his head. So, you know, even when these stories are untrue or proved to be untrue or there's no evidence, they still lead to real people being killed.
You wrote about people were fleeing some towns in Libya because of the stories of mass rape that they'd heard on satellite television.
Sure, yeah. I mean, who wants to find out the hard way? Who wants to, once people hear this, and then I met some people from Brega, an oil port, not very big, On the front line, and the people that, you know, there's no doubt the men were very worried about that women were going to get raped, and they're going to get raped by mercenaries. You know, they'd really taken all this stuff on board, although there's no evidence for it.
Now, it's not to say that there isn't or there wasn't significant harm done in places like Misrata and Benghazi. We know that there were dozens of people killed in incidents in both towns. I guess one of the questions becomes, how does this compare with what we're hearing out of Syria or Yemen? Certainly Gaddafi could have been capable of much worse, but do his crimes compare to what we're seeing in those countries?
Yeah, it's a much lower order of violence. People killed in the first couple of weeks fighting, that in Benghazi, it was about 100 to 110, in one town where there was also some fighting in the highlands, I think it was about 59 to 65. But, you know, we're talking in the probably below a couple of hundred in the first couple of weeks. This compares, you know, in Sana'a, in one day, government-supported gunmen shot dead 52 demonstrators. You know, there have been many more killed, and in Syria we don't know, but it appears from all the evidence from the anti-government groups and what you see on YouTube, that again, hundreds and hundreds of people have been killed, far more than in Libya.
There is a practical problem here, and you touched on it there, but it's worth underlining because you've written about this, about the Arab Spring uprisings. There are places journalists can't really get to, but YouTube is there and cell phones are there and they're being used to send out footage, which is either really empowering and provides a window into seeing what's going on there, or it becomes a way for journalists to be misled about a particular story.
Yeah, you see, I mean, two things happen. One, it can be just kind of faked, you know. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, this notorious business where a blogger who said their name was Gay Girl of Damascus turns out to be a 40-year-old bearded male American novelist living in Edinburgh in Scotland. You know, so the stuff like that. I was in Iran earlier in the year, and, you know, I was curious to see on YouTube pictures of demonstrations that I couldn't see in Tehran, but, you know, it's a big city, maybe I missed it. Then I noticed a strange thing, that all the demonstrators were just wearing shirts, but the temperature was only just above freezing. All the men were wearing jackets. I assumed that the pictures must have been taken from some other demonstration which took place in the summer. So, you know, it's easy to do that. And I think you can end up with a sort of distorted picture unless you have direct eyewitnesses to events.
We've been speaking with Patrick Coburn. He's foreign correspondent for The Independent. You can read his work on their website at independent.co.uk. Patrick Coburn, thank you for your time today here on Counterspin.
Thank you.
If the name Danziger Bridge eventually becomes as well known to Americans as Kent State, it will be in some part despite the press corps. A newspaper search for the last 6 months turns up next to nothing outside of Louisiana's Times-Picayune and AP Wire reports about the morning in September 2005 when New Orleans police officers opened fire on unarmed civilians escaping Katrina's floodwaters, killing two and wounding four. At the same time, any broader awareness of what happened on Danziger Bridge and afterward could also be in part because of reporters, those who didn't stop with official denials, who spoke to people who aren't often spoken to and believed them, and who kept a story alive that many would have preferred to go away. The trial of the officers began this week, giving journalists another opportunity to revisit some of the issues raised by Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath. We're joined now by one who never really left those stories. Jordan Flaherty is a journalist based in New Orleans, an editor of Left Turn magazine, and author of Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jordan Flaherty.
Thank you, Janine. This is my favorite show.
Oh, wonderful. Well, the trial of the police officers involved in the shootings on Danziger Bridge isn't just about opening fire on unarmed people. It's also about what happened afterward. I wonder if you could fill us in briefly on just what it seems happened that's led to these officers facing charges in court.
Well, there's so many dimensions to it, but certainly it seems clear from the prosecution case that the officers knew immediately that they had done something wrong in killing these two unarmed civilians and wounding four. The testimony involves officers standing above wounded, bleeding, unarmed civilians and firing at them point blank. But right after that, it seems this conspiracy began where officers began already changing their story, writing and rewriting their versions of the incident soon after, planting evidence, inventing witnesses, and continuing in a conspiracy that not only involves several years of these people conspiring, but also goes in some ways up to the very top of the department. You have the chief of police saying he never read the report of the incident. So at the very least, it involved people at the top ignoring what was going on, if not being actively complicit in it.
Well, we all remember the stories right after Katrina, mostly working a theme of poor black people revert to savagery in wake of catastrophe. that storytelling is really important because the police are actually using chaos as their defense. One lawyer says, quote, you can't judge them by today's standards, close quote. So that all those stories and rumors and things that we remember, they're actually going to say that's why what happened happened.
Well, Ginny, I think the media story of this is such a crucial element of it. I would go so far as to say I think the media may have done more damage to New Orleans than Hurricane Katrina. This depiction of people from New Orleans in the days after Katrina that shifted the public perception nationally and internationally from viewing people as victims trapped on roofs crying out for help to, as you say, savages, criminals, gangs, and thugs contributed to not only, I think, this police violence in the days after Katrina, this slow response, but this phenomenon reported a few months afterwards that the media dubbed Katrina fatigue, where people suddenly were saying, why are these people from New Orleans still having their hands out? Why should we still be helping them? I think that the fact that New Orleans still has not been rebuilt can really be traced back to those images in the days after Hurricane Katrina that drained public sympathy for the people of New Orleans. And even though now we know that so many of these stories of looters, of criminals, of gangs were in fact not true, and in fact that police were doing more looting than non-police, that public perception has done irreparable damage to the city.
Well, we have talked on this show about the role of journalists like yourself or like A.C. Thompson at ProPublica, like the team at the Times-Picayune, those journalists who have been digging out these stories of police brutality in particular and calling for justice. But you note in a recent piece that you wrote that it's come to light that along with the negative and inconsistent coverage from the big media, the national media, at least some local journalists played a quite unjournalistic role in these incidents. What is that story there?
I want to just very briefly talk about Alex Brandon, who is a photographer who was on the scene at Danziger soon after it happened. He was also there, one of the last people to see Henry Glover, or to be at the scene after police had shot Henry Glover and before they burned his body.
Right.
And there's this incredible thing coming from his own testimony in the Henry Glover trial, where he was there at the scene where the people that tried to rescue Henry Glover were being beaten by police officers. Henry Glover was in a car bleeding, and he thought about taking a picture, and an officer told him not to, and he didn't. And then a staffer from the ATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, goes and takes a picture. Alex Brandon goes to this officer and says, hey, those officers said not to take a picture. And the guy from ATF turns to this journalist and says, I don't work for them. Mm-hmm. It's really clearly implying that the journalist does, you know, and he testified that he was close to these officers, that they were friends of his, and he knew more about this story than he told. And he, I think, really helped to cover it up. He later left the Times-Picayune and went to Associated Press. And I think it's really systematic of this problem in our local media. And, you know, you mentioned the Times-Picayune, and I've gotten angry calls from folks at the Times-Picayune for my criticism of their coverage. But I think that for years they were not interested in the story. And I want to draw a parallel between the Times-Picayune and the New Orleans Police Department. These were both institutions that for much of the 20th century were explicitly racist institutions where black people could not work and where their leadership very explicitly said things against black people. Now, both those institutes have changed and have had since then black people in high up positions of power, the New Orleans Police Department more so than the Times-Picayune.
Right.
But they've still never changed as an institution. I think they've never had the kind of systematic change that I think has completely separated them from their past. And for decades, the New Orleans Times-Picayune was not really interested in these stories of police violence.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it was the black media in town, papers like Louisiana Weekly, that really told those stories. With the collapse of the black press in general in this country, there is no longer that strong black press in New Orleans, and we really felt the lack. And I think it wasn't until A.C. Thompson came and really shamed the entire local press corps by telling these stories that our entire local media had ignored for more than 3 years that then you saw the entire local media come on board and start reporting on Danziger Bridge and these other things. But for years, if you talk to people in the community, they feel the press was not doing the job and was being silent about these stories of police violence that were widely talked about in the city, in the black community. But the paper and the television programs were not telling those stories.
Well, that leads me actually just to my next question, which you cite a woman, Dana Kaplan, from the Juvenile Justice Project in Louisiana, saying just that, that there were individuals and groups, talking specifically about Danziger Bridge now, who were trying to talk about what had happened, but they weren't listened to. And I can't help but believe that that who gets listened to, who gets believed, has incredible implications beyond, of course, just this story.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't want to be reductionist, right? You don't have to be black and from New Orleans to be able to tell this story. And in fact, A.C. Thompson proved that by being someone white and not being from New Orleans. But if you are a New Orleans media institution and you have very few staff people who are black and from New Orleans, then it's going to create problems. You know, the Soros Institute recently funded this project called The Lens to do investigative reporting in New Orleans, and they have almost no staff who are black or from New Orleans. And, you know, they've gotten $500,000 for this project. And I think the main problem is it doesn't address the systemic problem of these voices that aren't heard from. It's a deep problem in our media, in the city, and I think in this country, that when voices aren't represented in the staff of a paper, sometimes the stories that that community is interested in and that that community knows about are not represented. In New Orleans, we have a black radio station, WBOK, and if you listen to WBOK every day, you hear incredible anger at the Times-Picayune and at the media institutions for not covering the stories that the listeners of that radio station feel are important.
We've been speaking with journalist Jordan Flaherty, author of Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina Six. Thanks very much for joining us on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.